My name is Ed Gaffney, and I work at Valparaiso University in Indiana. In line with the great theme and the overarching theme of the conferences or the talks this summer, which is that we should have a whole new world. There's a pun involved there about the new world, that 500 years ago Columbus came to this part of the world and Europeans thought it was new, and of course it was quite ancient to the people who lived here for tens of thousands of years, or at least millennia before Columbus got here. And the way I intend to relate to that theme is in two ways. One, by returning us to the ancient world, to the world of pretty much of ancient Israel, which is not the world of Columbus exactly. Ironically, we will find that the year of the discovery of the New World by Columbus was also the year in which Jews were cast out of Spain, along with Muslims. Indeed, there's another set of talks that you can plug into that will explore that dimension of North American history that is going to lay that out all out for you. So if you can't hear those talks in person, you can perhaps listen to them on tape. And that's one of the advantages of the village that you ought to also to be aware of, is that these conversations are all recorded, so you can listen to them later. Well, I want to pay attention to the expulsion of the Jews from Spain and explore the possibility that that might have for us in 1992, 500 years later, for getting in touch with the newness of our world, a world which is full of promise of overcoming ancient hatreds. Next week, one of the units that I will be leading a discussion on will be called The Deepest Love and the Longest Hatred, because I regard God's love for his people Israel as the deepest that there possibly can be, and Christian hatred towards Jews as one of the saddest and longest hatreds of the world's history. One of the most continuous, ongoing conflicts that only in our century, after the so-called end solution to the so-called Jewish question, which of course was never a question for Jews, but a question for Gentiles about their attitude towards Jews. But in order to set in context what I'm attempting to do this week, which is basically to reread some of the Hebrew Bible from the eyes of a Christian in the late 20th century heading towards the end of the millennium, in a way that can form a bridge between Jews and Christians, it might be helpful if we just owned up right at the beginning to the tragic character of this long, long hatred. And so I'm going to read first from an ancient Roman historian, Tacitus, to give you something of the flavor of that it wasn't just Christians that hated Jews. This is a very famous pagan historian. And this is what he has to say. Who are these Jews? Of all enslaved peoples, they are the most contemptible. A loathsome people, at once full of superstition and hostile to all religious practice. The people whose customs are absurd and sordid. All that we hold sacred is profane to them. All that is licit to them is impure to us. Pretty categorical, pretty sweeping, pretty broad. And now, something that I will attempt to explore much more fully next week in the conversation a week from today on Monday. Let me read to you from some of the sermons of a 4th century bishop from Antioch by the name of John. We generally called him the Golden Tongue One, John Chrysostom. He lived from the years 344 to 407, so he bridged the century, 4th and 5th century. What does he have to say about the Jews? A whole day long sermon would not suffice to tell all that is wrong with them. But he gives it a stab. How can Christians dare have the slightest conversation with Jews, the most miserable of all people? People who are lustful, rapacious, greedy, perfidious bandits, are they not inveterate murderers, destroyers, people possessed by the devil, whom debauchery and drunkenness have given them the manners of a pig or a lusty goat? They know only one thing, to satisfy their gullets, get drunk, kill, and maim one another. Indeed, they have surpassed the ferocity of wild beasts, for they murder their offspring and immolate them to the devil. They are impure and impious. It was while rereading this homily, this sermon, that I saw the allusion to one of the most precious and most difficult passages in the Hebrew Bible to comprehend, namely the story of the binding of Isaac. Let me read from John Chrysostom again. They murder their offspring and immolate them to the devil. It was in rereading this sermon that I took the idea that it would be well for us as Christians to reread the Hebrew Bible with empathy, with respect, with an attempt to reach out to our brothers and sisters who are Jews, and to respect their scriptures in the historic period in which they were given these precious records of their faith, and then to renew our own faith as Christians in the face of it. But before I do so, let me conclude my sort of introductory comments on Christian anti-Semitism, which is, of course, a contradiction in terms. One cannot be a Christian and an anti-Semite. Yet it is a sad fact that Christians are anti-Semitic. This is a citation from an Orthodox Christian, Eastern Orthodox Christian theologian who has pondered about this matter for many, many years, and he puts it this way. This is Father Lofsky, an historian. In the final analysis, there can be no debate. There are too many signs that stake out the permanence, the importance, and the gravity of Christian anti-Semitism. Contempt, calumnies, animosity, segregation, forced baptisms, appropriation of children, unjust trials, pogroms, exile, systematic persecution, thefts, and rape, hatred, open or concealed, social degradation. It's quite a terrible indictment. And it causes us to be humble in the face of the task before us, which is to reclaim the Hebrew Bible in a manner that is clearly opposed to the spirit of the first century heretic or early second century heretic by the name of Marcion, who basically told Christians that they need not read the Hebrew Bible at all, that there was nothing in there of gain for them, that they had only to stick by the New Testament. Or indeed, the very way in which we refer to the Old Testament is not with the veneration of the ages of faith, but old in contrast to new, that it's simply leading up to the big, great events of Christianity. There's something that is profoundly misguided in that appreciation, and hence scholars that work in this area don't really call it the Old Testament anymore. They call it the Hebrew Bible or the Hebrew Scriptures. It's a way of acknowledging the sacred character of the text for the Jews that we are attempting to unfold. So, my first text, so to speak, to read together with you is called The Binding of Isaac in Hebrew, the Akedah HaYisak, and we're going to say lots about Isaac and how he got his name and so forth like that, and why this story has so much poignancy is in part because of this youth, or actually he's, some of the rabbi's comments, is thought to be 37 years old at the time of this event, which will tell you how heroic he was in going forward to the sacrificial table that his father laid him on. In any event, the rocky foundation, to pick up the rock theme for today, of our faith is found in our father Abraham. And when I say our father Abraham, I mean Jews, Christians, and Muslims. All three of the great historic world religions, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, claim Abraham, this person of deep, deep faith who heard the call of his God and left his comfortable place to journey out to a strange and unknown, unnamed place. At least you knew the name of Holden Village before you came here. You may have had as difficult a journey, not really, as he, in leaving the Chaldees to venture out in faith to a place that you didn't know much about but wanted to come here. Well, there's a way in which we're sort of like Abraham, making this journey of faith throughout life. Our very presence here at Holden Village perhaps reflects that. In any event, let's deal first of all with the context before we deal with the text. The text is found in the 22nd chapter of Genesis, but first let me say a few things about the context. And if you would turn in your Bibles to the book of Deuteronomy, that's found after the book of Numbers and before the book of Joshua, in case you're flipping from back to front or front to back. Then turn to chapter 26, and we'll get right into the flavor of what the life of worship of ancient Israel was like. Like worship in the ancient world generally, worship in ancient Israel had lots to do with holidays or with holy days, with high occasions when the whole people would gather together for acts of praise and worship and thanksgiving. This one that I'm going to highlight now is taken from the fall festival of Sukkot, or booths, or it's a time of gathering of the harvest in the fall, and it's a time when the people come to the place that is appointed for worship, perhaps the sanctuary at Shiloh, or perhaps, which was not exactly the Civil War battlefield, but of American history, but it's a little bit further back in time before that. And I will tell you a little bit about Civil War history in a minute. Let's just read what a typical prayer would be like at such a ceremony. Would somebody read to us from verses 5 down to 11 of chapter 26 of Deuteronomy? Who has the text already open there? 26, yeah, please, would you read that out for us?
From 5 through what?
To 11.
And you shall answer and say before the Lord your God, my father was a Syrian about to perish, and he went down to Egypt and sojourned there, few in number, and there he became a nation great, mighty, and populous. But the Egyptians mistreated us, afflicted us, and laid hard bondage on us. Then we cried out to the Lord God of our fathers, and the Lord heard our voice and looked on our affliction and our labor and our oppression. So the Lord brought us out of Egypt with a mighty hand and with an outstretched arm, with great terror and with signs and wonders. He has brought us to this place and has given us this land, a land flowing with milk and honey. And now behold, I have brought the first fruits of the land which you, O Lord, have given me. Then you shall set it before the Lord your God, and worship before the Lord your God. So you shall rejoice in every good thing which the Lord your God has given to you and your house, you and the Levite and the stranger who is among you.
Thank you. It may strike us, first of all, that this is an odd way to celebrate nature. And the answer is that it is not a celebration of nature. It's really a telling of a story, isn't it? It's recalling the memory of the ancestors. It's associated with the time of the year when you bring forward various gifts of nature in the festival of gathering of the fruits of the harvest and so on. And yet it is not a blessing that goes, oh God, we thank you for the beauty of Holden Village. We love the beautiful trees around us. We adore your mountains. And we think you're just a fantastic thundering voice. There are such psalms and there's such evidence of the contact between Israel and that kind of a nature deity. But at the heart of Israel's faith is what Gerhard von Rad, a German scholar, has called this historical credo. That is to say that the faith of ancient Israel is centered in a story, and it is the story of our ancestors. As I've heard you narrate it, it sounds like had somebody was wandering around, let's call that person Israel, or call him by his other name, Jacob. A wandering Aramean, some of the texts might say, is my father. The father that is being referred to is Father Israel. The nation has its origin in these people who went before us in faith. And then the first thing that we find about him is he went down to Egypt, and times got were fine for a while, and then times got tough. So down into Egypt, in Egypt, out of Egypt, and into the land. Those are the four phases, so to speak, the four important moments of this sacred history. And the first five books of the Bible, sometimes called in Greek Pentateuch, or five parts, five scrolls, are often thought of as a unity. And yet, precisely because they don't tell the story of Israel's entry into the land, we heard Fred Niedner this morning at the Bible study tell us that out of God's great love for rocks, he punished Moses for his rock abuse of tapping the rock in the wilderness twice instead of once, and so he didn't get to go into the land. There are all kinds of puns on rocks that you hear today. That's one. So the basic story then that frames our story about the binding of Isaac is the precious memory of the faith of the ancestors and who they were and what they were up to. And the point that I want to make right at the beginning of our study of the Binding of Isaac passage is that any group or minyan, as it's called, any gathering of Jews that gets together to study these five books of the Bible called the Torah, or the Law, the Instruction of Moses, always does so, let's say in 1992, that there's some other village, call it Shmolden village, where Jews are gathered at precisely the same moment as we are gathered here. Well, they would always start with the presupposition, what are we reading Torah for? It's to find out something about ourselves in 1992. Why? Because we are the children of the covenant. We are the B'nai B'rith, as the Hebrew word for it calls. We are the sons and daughters of Abraham. We are the sons and daughters of Sarah, of Isaac, and Rebecca, and Jacob, and Leah. We are their ancestors. We are their daughters. We are their sons. And these stories are always supposed to be searched out in a way that connects with our lives in the present moment. So that's, I guess, the overriding principle of interpretation that I will try to bring to this discussion. Now, one other sort of context thing, and then we'll get on to our text. The structure, as we saw from the passage in Deuteronomy, is this notion of the promise to the ancestors that they would eventually come to a land, and indeed, as we'll see more specifically, that Abraham would have lots of kids. So those are the two big promises. One, and I invite you to look up at the stars tonight and see how many you can count, because that's the metaphor. Now that we have clear skies, that's the metaphor that is used several times in the Abraham story to describe the posterity, the children of Abraham. And they, of course, include us, as we will see later on in the tale. The story of the ancestors, there are basically six big ones, Abraham and Sarah, Isaac and Rebekah, Jacob and Leah, is framed by the first 11 chapters of Genesis that talk about primitive or the primeval or the very beginning point of history, namely the creation, the emergence of Adam and Eve, the fall, the sin, the redemption, the seeking out of a people that would survive the terribly centrifugal forces of sin that were introduced into the world long before the ancestors. And that, of course, is the great figure Noah. And the first time that we get binding relationships between God and the human family, first with Adam, and then with Noah. This idea of a binding relationship was one that was familiar to the ancients, and it's kind of a political relationship in which a powerful they were called emperors, but they were more like mayors of contemporary cities, would promise to take care of another group. These treaties, or covenants, as they were also called, had rules that went with them, the stipulations, and we'll take a look at those on Wednesday of this week. But for now, we get the picture that the primeval history of Genesis 1 to 11 is the sort of starting point of Genesis, and then we get from chapters 12 through the remainder of Genesis, the story about these six great ancestors. And then the story of them going down into Egypt, as you read to us from Deuteronomy 26. And eventually we'll get to Joshua, where they come out of the, or we'll see in Exodus next tomorrow afternoon, that they come out of Egypt, but they don't get into the land just yet. Then these four moments that we saw in the historical credo, namely down into Egypt, in Egypt, the land of oppression, out of Egypt, the deliverance, the rescue, and eventually into the land, that the central theme that is sort of running through that, or the one word that recurs over and over again, or the one idea, is that of the promise to Abraham. And just to review, who can remember what the two promises were? Promise of what? What did God promise Abraham?
New land.
New land. And tons of kids. Yeah, tons of kids. Our posterity is so broad that you couldn't count them by sifting out all the sands in the seashore or the stars in the sky. Well, if that's the central deal that God has cut, and literally that's the verb for the kind of deal that God makes with Abraham, it's not a 50-50 proposition, but an animal is cut in half in the covenant that we hear about Abraham. And it's a kind of perhaps a brutal or a shocking metaphor for those of us that have never lived near butchers. But the idea was that if I were to break this agreement, this treaty, this relationship with God, or with the emperor or whoever, then may I be cut in half just like this animal. And we see in that story this mysterious symbol of God, the pot of fire passing through this animal and the other person walking through Abraham, and they're sort of bonding that way and saying, I'm really going to stick it out with you. I'm going to, and God in effect is saying to Abraham, I'm going to be there for you always and forever. There's never going to be any going back on my word, on this covenant, on this bond. And it's a promise that you have the land and lots of kids. It's improbable that he'll have lots of kids, because his first act of faith and trust is to leave his home and go out on this hazardous, dangerous journey from Ur of the Chaldees, as it's called in the Bible. What we mean by that is Iraq, in modern-day terms, to go from there all the way over to what was then Canaan, or now we call it Israel. It's sort of like, leaving Bangor, Maine, and heading for San Diego without much of a compass, or walking across a vast continent. And you can imagine Sarah, thrilled as she was, to set out on this journey. We'll see in one of the stories that the rabbis tell that Sarah, although she's a silent character in some of the stories, turns out to have a very important comment on the binding of Isaac. Let's get to Sarah. She's 80 in the shade, and he's 100 when this improbable promise of lots of offspring gets fulfilled. Abraham gets a little testy about when this promise is going to be fulfilled, and then he gets a little antsy and anticipatory, and has some sex on the side, so to speak. He has a slave by the name of Hagar. Conveniently for our historical credo, she turns out to be an Egyptian woman, and her child, who is called Ishmael, which is the way that Muslims trace their lineage back to Abraham, is through Ishmael, Hagar, Abraham's lover from Egypt. And we see, nope, that isn't it. Hagar is not the son of the promise. He is not the one through whom this great promise is going to be fulfilled. It is Sarah. And she finds this utterly laughable. She just has a great chuckle over that. So let's face it, if anyone were past menopause even by a couple of years, they would find it difficult to think that they would have the womb that would conceive the child of promise for billions of children to come. And so she finds it laughable. She goes, ha, ha, ha. And, but God's messenger overhears her laughing and says, just because you laughed at this promise, I'm telling you what, when I come back next year and you have a kid, I'm going to tell you the name of that child. And it is Laughing One, or, you know, like the Native Americans have Hiawatha, you know, the Laughing Waters, ha, ha, ha. Yeah, wa-ha-ha. Well, so also with Yitzhak in Hebrew, it has an onomatopoetic character that means that the very name tells you something of the sound of what this person is like. He's the son of laughter, or a laughing boy, or something like that. You know, the way, again, Native Americans give names to people that correspond to something about that person. It's not really Kevin Costner up there, it's Dances with Wolves. That's what his real name is. Besides which, the Dakota tribe would have had trouble pronouncing the name Kevin Costner, or the other fictitious name that he had in the story. Easier to say Dances with Wolves. Well, that's what we're going to call this child of promise, Yitzhak, Laughing Boy. There are even some points in which the promise becomes terribly imperiled. There's a couple of stories about that. They're called doublets. If one story is good, then tell it again. And we've all had that experience, I suppose, around our family table at Thanksgiving or campfires or whatever, where Aunt Matilda's memory of the same event that perhaps your father participated in 50 years ago is dramatically different and gets retold in different ways and from year to year. Then pretty soon there's a different version. You're not even sure it's in the same city or that it's the same people that were involved in the story. Well, the first betrayal of Sarah is right after the promise in Genesis chapter 12. The bearer of the promise is rescued, Sarah is rescued from the threat of being taken into the harem of Pharaoh. The people in the ancient world hadn't hit upon monogamy, at least among the more powerful folks. They had lots of women, that is, say, the men did. Have lots of women at their beck and call, and Sarah was going to be called into the harem. Well, if she were, then how would the promise be fulfilled? It would be the end of the story. It would be a pretty short story. It probably wouldn't even be published in the New Yorker. I promise you, you can have kids as big as numerous as the stars in the sky, and then the wife gets sold into slavery. End of story. A very short story indeed. And the promise comes to a rapid end. Well, no, God is not going to let his story come to so quick an end. And so he rescues Sarah from the harem of Pharaoh and restores both of them to the land of Israel. So already we're getting allusions back again to this historical cradle, down into Egypt and up again. In chapter 20, we're told, after now it's clarified that she is to be the mother of the son of promise. She is the sole vehicle of this promised son. Again, she's exposed to danger with a king by the name of Abimelech. It seems like Abraham either A, doesn't learn from what he went through in Egypt, or else maybe we have two family stories, two different tribes, two different parts of the country remembering these stories with important differences that have to do with the clan or the tribe in which the story is being told. Okay? And here's where I want to kick in the American Civil War. A friend of mine who, with whom I came to Indiana many years ago, had a child in the first grade in Virginia. We were both in Virginia at the time. We both moved to Indiana to join the law faculty at Notre Dame. And he came home from school one day and said, Daddy, I'm really confused about this war business. He said, well, what war business? He said, well, last year we called it the war between the states, and this year we call it the Civil War. And I was wondering how a war could be civil. So that was a pretty thoughtful question for a second grader. And his father tried to explain to him what that war was about and so forth. And he says, well, I'm still confused. He says, well, what are you confused about still? He says, well, last year, our teacher told us we lost the war. This year, she told us that we won. So as to how you remember what it is that the past has to tell us. It's not only given a different name in different regions of this country, the war among the states, the war between the states, and the Civil War, or depends on whether or not you remember you know, power of God, this and that in your family history, or do you remember people like Useless Grant as the great hero? So also here, we have different ways of remembering the stories. And we'll explore that a little bit more tomorrow afternoon. Now sort of on to the story with one final piece of context. It's just to remember very with sharp clarity that Isaac, laughing boy, is the son of the promise. He's now born and alive and well. And it's through him that these millions and millions of other children, namely you and me, are to be found. Well, let's begin then our text. After these things, God tested Abraham, and the verb is very important. We, the readers, are given a clue that he, Abraham, didn't have at the time of these events, that this is a temptation narrative, this is a test narrative, a test as to what that's going to divide us, or at least divide the opinions. But let's get a couple of people reading this passage. One of you would like to read the first want you to read the first 10 verses. A man should read that, please. Some man that has the text. Read it with as bold a voice as you can. We're in chapter 22. We finally got out of context and we're now reading this story, folks. And we're in chapter 22 of the book of Genesis, and I'd like a man to read us the first 10 verses. Okay, please.
After these things, God tested Abraham. He said to him, Abraham, and he said, here I am. He said, take your son, your only son Isaac, whom you love, and go to the land of Moriah, and offer him there as a burnt offering on one of the mountains that I shall show you. So Abraham rose early in the morning, saddled his donkey, and took two of his young men with him, and his son Isaac. He cut the wood for the burnt offering, and set out and went to the place in the distance where God had shown him. On the third day, Abraham looked up and saw the place far away. Then Abraham said to his young men, stay here with the donkey. The boy and I will go over there. We will worship, and then we will come back to you. Abraham took the wood of the burnt offering and laid it on his son Isaac, and he himself carried the fire and the knife. So the two of them walked on together. Isaac said to his father Abraham, Father, and he said, here I am, my son. He said, the fire and the wood are here, but where is the lamb for the burnt offering? Abraham said, God himself will provide the lamb for the burnt offering, my son. So the two of them walked on together. How far do you want?
Two more verses, 9 and 10.
Okay. When they came to the place that God had shown them, Abraham built an altar there and laid the wood in order. He bound his son Isaac and laid him on the altar on top of the wood. Then Abraham reached out his hand and took the knife to kill his son.
Okay, now I'd like a woman to read from 11, say down to 18 or so.
But the angel of the Lord called out to him from heaven, Abraham, Abraham. Here I am, he replied. Do not lay a hand on the boy, he said. Do not do anything to him. Now I know that you fear God because you have not withheld from me your son, your only son. Abraham looked up, and there in the thicket he saw a ram caught by the horns. He went over and took the ram and sacrificed it as a burnt offering instead of his son. So Abraham called the place, the Lord will provide. And to this day it is said, on the mountain of the Lord it will be provided. The angel of the Lord called to Abraham from heaven a second time and said, I swear by myself, declares the Lord, that because you have done this and have not withheld your son, your only son, I will surely bless you and make your descendants as numerous as the stars in the sky and as the sand on the seashore. Your descendants will take possessions of the cities of your enemies, and through your offspring all nations on the earth will be blessed, because you have obeyed me.
Going back to the male voice, if you'd read us verse 19.
So Abraham returned to his young men, and they arose and went together to Beersheba, and Abraham lived at Beersheba.
Now, I referred before to the North and the South and the American Civil War, or betrayed my prejudice, and I grew up a Yankee Northerner, so I think of it as the Civil War, and I think we won it, although I'm always doubtful about wars. But in any event, that metaphor, I think, is used by some scholars to describe the differences in the story. One of them is that it has the word God in it. We heard the male voice, God commanding Abraham to take the life of his dear darling, as Benjamin Britten calls it. The way he's put this story to music starts with a very evocative, beautiful, simple line. It goes like this. Abraham, my servant, dear Abraham, take Isaac, thy dear darling, and in sacrifice offer him to me. What an improbable command for the God of mercy, the God of life, the God of joy. And Sarah, the voice that is not heard from in this story, turns up in a Jewish rabbinical comment called a midrash, and we'll hear lots of them this week, as putting an important question to Abraham. What kind of God told you to do that? She says. Are you sure this is our God? And he says, oh yeah, I got it in a dream last night. The ancients often got messages from their gods in dreams, and we're told he starts off right at the beginning of the next morning, goes out, chops the wood, gets the kid, and goes off on this journey. So it's that part of the rabbinic comment makes sense. But are you sure this is God that is talking to you? Says Sarah. That's a very important question. Or who's God? Which God? God, you know, of the ancient world speaks in many different ways. And are you sure this is our God? Well, he's absolutely sure of that. She's not so sure. She doesn't think this is a good idea at all. And she tries to restrain him. But nothing will do but that Abraham carries out the voice that he hears telling him, impelling him to take his kid to sacrifice. The story, according to this midrash, with respect to Sarah, is that she shrieks out in defiance against such a God, says, don't you believe that that's the real God? And she dies. Now that's an interesting detail that is not found in Genesis 22, but after all, it is the point of Genesis 23, in which Abraham finally gets some peace, some real estate of the land. And he does so by purchasing Sarah's gravesite. We don't hear much about Sarah, either in 22 or 23. Indeed, the whole 23 is filled with all kinds of commercial bargaining with these people about how can he really get the land, and eventually winds up getting this thing. But that's one voice that sort of can help us understand the, at least that this chapter is a story that needs very careful reading. Let me just go through these verses that we've just heard read by two of us pretty quickly, making a couple of comments on them, and then move on to the way Christians have interpreted the story, and then back to the way Jews have interpreted the story. This perhaps most moving story of the book of Genesis, it has a note of importance to it right at the beginning with this very, very simple introduction. Juxtaposed with this extraordinarily heavy command, go kill the child of promise. We, as I said, know that it's a test. He didn't know that it was just a temptation of his faith and that there was really a ram in the bush when you get out there. We've heard the story often enough that we know what the outcome is. But put yourself for a moment in his position right at the beginning. He doesn't know that. He hears this voice and he's told, he's commanded, kill the child of promise. What an extraordinary way to test faith. And then the utter simplicity of his response, the complete docility to this word, this obedience of faith that Abraham embodies throughout the whole Abraham saga. So Abraham arose early in the morning. You do it. You're told to do something, you do it. We're told that it's for a holocaust, and I will get to that next Monday to flesh out some of the extraordinary dimension to that word in our own century. But in the ancient world, a holocaust simply meant a burnt offering, hence the necessity for the cut wood. The typical holocaust sacrifice in the temple at Jerusalem was of a lamb or a ram in this story. We're told later in the story that indeed a ram conveniently shows up for the actual sacrifice. We're told furthermore that on the third day of this journey of faith, you can see the place, and that's the kind of a preoccupation with the biblical authors. They always love journeys of 3 days. In Exodus, for example, Moses tells Pharaoh that the Israelites need to get away from the Egyptian territory in a 3-day march to find a place where they worship the Yahweh. When they go from one place to the other in the wilderness, they always go on these 3-day camping expeditions. And so here too, there's one of these 3-day journey of faiths. Abraham and Isaac together leave the young men, the servants that are accompanying him to out on this long journey, to be by themselves. And then I want to ask the man over here who read to us verse 5, who comes back in verse 19 at the end? You told us that they went out together in verse 5. Who comes back in 19?
They.
Well, maybe your Bible is different. Mine is a little different. Mine reads this way. So Abraham returned to his young men. It doesn't say so Abraham and Isaac did. So one version of the story has only Abraham coming back. Now I'm doing this to sort of bridge over to the typical way the Jews would read this story. But I'll get there in a minute. Just hold on to that as a big question. Who comes back? Or put it differently, where's Isaac? The wood in verse 6 is laid on Isaac, a particular detail that will be terribly significant to early Christian commentators, bishops like Irenaeus and Augustine will make much of that fact and compare it to Jesus bearing the wood of his cross, just as people executed for crucifixion 2,000 Jews on a particular day. The Romans didn't particularly single out Jesus as a big deal from their perspective. He was just another one of their victims in Palestine. And it's important to remember that when we come up against the charge of the Jews as the deicide people, the people who kill God, that our creed puts it differently. It says that Jesus suffered and died under Pontius Pilate. But we'll deal with that a little bit later, namely next week, those that are able to stay that long. Now, I want to point out that in verse 7 and 8, we get the first father-son or daddy-son conversation between Abraham and Isaac that just adds more tension to the drama because the father is evasive. He doesn't answer the kid's legitimate question, hey, where's the lamb? That's the usual thing that goes on in these sacrifice thing. Where's the lamb? Don't worry about it, he says. God himself will provide a victim. You can imagine if you're Isaac, hey, it's time to start worrying. What's going on here? So this poignant conversation really puts the psychological tension into the narrative if it weren't there in verse 1.
Excuse me?
Yes.
How old was Isaac?
Well, we don't know in the story. Some of the rabbis speculate that he was 37 years of age because they put him, maybe I'll just jump ahead to the Jewish interpretation of this story. They want him to be 40 years old when he gets back to A. One possibility is console Sarah, that he's been away so long and didn't get back, you know, at least by midnight. And she's been wondering where he is. Or B, he's gone to study Torah, he's gone to study the scriptures of ancient Israel, or C, he's gone to paradise and been restored from the wounds that his father inflicted upon him. And that gets to this point, where did he go? Well, they want him to be 37 years old so that he can have a 3-year journey, not just a 3-day journey, and that the tears of the angels weeping over this terrible father who would take the knife to his son yet a second time, because they say a second time the voice of the angel interrupts here and says, no, don't do that, stop, hold the story. There's another thing you need to know about the God of Israel, is that he does not honor, he is not worshipped by human sacrifice. The immolation of animals in the temple is one thing, but the slaughter of the innocent, the weak, and the helpless is quite another. So how old he is, well, the text of the Bible doesn't tell us, but these commentaries by the rabbis fill in the blanks, so to speak. And it's exactly the kind of question that a Jew would put in reading the scriptures. They wonder about all kinds of details like that. They certainly wonder, you know, where's Isaac in verse 19? And that becomes a very big thing. So your question is exactly right for opening up this kind of imaginative response that the rabbis would give. Please, you had a question as well.
Right. In verse 5, and you're talking about 19 and 5, it says, stay here with the donkey while I and the boy go over there. We will worship, and then we will come back to you.
Right.
What's the significance of that? If he knew that he was going to be sacrificed at this place, he told the servants, we're coming back. Look.
Well, why verse 19 doesn't say that they come back together.
No, I know that, but I mean, why would he have said that in the first place if he knew he was going to be sacrificed?
Well, maybe he didn't know. Maybe this is a journey of faith. Maybe he was being told to do something that was very bewildering and confusing to him.
Or Isaac wouldn't go.
Yeah, let's put it that way. That's another way of putting it. The story in its final form is surely intended by its author, or the editor that puts these stories together, assuming that there are two stories going on, not simply to illustrate some general truth about child sacrifice and its substitution by animal sacrifice in the history of Israel, or the location of a cultic center, because we don't get it precise, it's not said, this is Shiloh, or this is Jerusalem. Later, after the exile, one of the later books, namely the Book of Chronicles, will identify the place of Moriah as the Temple Mount, but that's not probable at the time of Abraham for a couple of reasons. One, Jerusalem was already a developed city at the time of Abraham, and two, there aren't the kind of mountains around that are described in the story. So that's a later way of thinking about it. This is like 5th century way of thinking about the story before the Common Era. In short, we get back to the central theme of Torah itself, namely that the God of promise will not be frustrated in his design to create a people, that he wishes to have a firm covenant bond with the people of Israel that are the sons and daughters of Abraham, and that in his own mysterious and magnificent way, he brings that to pass in a way that is utterly bewildering to us and that is beyond our possibility to comprehend at the outset of the story. How could that be if you killed the child of promise? Well, in God's own way, that will unfold in a very different way that's beyond your wildest imagination. So just hang around there for a little bit longer into the story and you'll see how it spins out. And we, of course, are Christians here. So we hang around in a slightly different way. We bring to this story a memory of how God deals with the creation of his people in and through his dear darling, his son, his only son, Jesus. For example, I don't even want anybody here to turn to the 3rd chapter of John and read out loud the 16th verse. I just want somebody to say it. John 3:16. Okay, now that verb, to give one's son, has all kinds of resonance for a Christian that would be familiar with the Hebrew Bible and would take some reference to there. The same gospel has Jesus bearing the wood of the cross in the Passion narrative in chapter 19, verse 17. It makes that, inserts that particular detail into the story so that Jesus is the new Isaac going forward to this sacrificial death, and so on. And then Romans 8:32 brings in the same theme, that he who did not spare his own son, but gave him up for us all, will he not also give all things with him, give us all things with him? Well, what did he give to his son? He gave him the gift of new life that makes him the brother to all of us, his sisters and brothers, in new life and the new people of God. Who then are the heirs to the promise of Abraham? Well, for Paul, that's an easy question to answer. First of all, I guess in the sermons of Peter in Jerusalem, it means the Jews who are alive at the time of hearing the message. They are the heirs of the promise of Abraham. If they can get it, if they can hear that these events have now sort of taken on a fresh new dimension, then they too will be the heirs of the promise to Abraham. They'll be part of the people of Abraham. But as we know, Paul, at a later moment in Christian history, writes a letter to Christians in Galatia, where he's having trouble with Jewish rules, Jewish laws being imposed on Gentile Christians, and he wants to make a point that everybody, Jews and Gentiles, can be sons and daughters of Abraham. We're all heirs of the promise of Abraham, he says in Galatians 3, 6 to 9. And then perhaps a year or so later, but in any event at the same time period, in the letter to the Christians at Rome, he makes the same point in chapter 4, that the true descendants of Abraham are those who have faith in Jesus. And whether you're a Jew or a Gentile doesn't matter, he says, that the God in whom Abraham believed gives life to the dead and calls into existence things that were not. In the hope that Abraham believed against hope, how could you state at the beginning of the Binding of Isaac story that your hope and the promise would be fulfilled by killing your kid? And yet, that kind of hope, that kind of astonishing faith, is what enabled him to become the father of many nations, says Paul. And just as his faith was reckoned by God as setting up a new relationship, the consequences of that are that it's not just for Abraham, but for all of us who believe in God. Why? And here we get the earliest, one of the very earliest statements of the Christian formula of our faith, just like the one that you read to us is one of the earliest formula of the faith of ancient Israel, the so-called historical credo in Deuteronomy 26. So also here in Romans 4:25, we get the formula that Jesus our Lord, who was put to death for our trespasses and raised for our justification. That will give the clue that then will enable Jews to begin to reinterpret the Binding of Isaac story. Why? Because the story was used by Christians as a taunt. Once Christians got into power in the 4th century, they began to ridicule Jewish faith and say, well, the Binding of Isaac story doesn't go very far, does it? Abraham, quote, offered up Isaac, but really not. Really, it was only a lamb that was offered there, whereas we Christians have the perfect sacrifice. Now, that's not the perspective of the New Testament. Indeed, the letter to the Hebrews in chapter 11 tells us something different. Abraham offered up Isaac, considering that God was able to raise a person even from the dead. Hence, figuratively speaking, he did receive him back. Well, the later Jewish interpretations, that is to say, after the Christian era, began to wrestle with this Christian taunt, with this idea that we had a better version of the story. And so they started to improve the story too, through a style that is very imaginative and creative. They would answer your detail, how old was the kid, stuff like that. Let me let me just read you a couple of those kinds of comments, and I'm afraid we're running out of time, so we're not going to develop these midrashes, as they're called, in very great detail. Here's one from roughly the year 150 of the Common Era, so second century of the Christian period. He said before him, Master of the whole universe, The moment you said to me, take now your son, your favorite one, I could have retorted, yesterday you said to me, for it is through Isaac that your offspring will be continued for me. And now today you say to me, take this kid and kill him. But heaven forbid that I did not act in that way. On the contrary, I suppressed my retort to you so that you would have pity. So may it be thy will, O Lord our God, whenever Isaac's children get into distress, to recall the binding of Isaac on their behalf, and do you be filled with compassion for them. Here are three more spins on the same kind of an imaginative interpretation. We're, I see, out of time, so that means we're out of tape, and we're also out of time. Let me just read one of them. So may it be thy will, O Lord our God, whenever Isaac's children enter into distress, that when there's no one to speak up for them as their advocate, do thou speak up as their advocate. Do thou be merciful and remember the binding of their father Isaac, and be filled with compassion for them. Eventually, the story turns out to be that Abraham did kill his son Isaac, and that through the magnificent compassion and mercy of God, God restored Isaac to Sarah after 3 years of study of Torah, or being swept off by the tears of the angels into a magnificent stream that flowed back into the Garden of Eden, where he recuperated from the wounds that his father had inflicted upon him. And then eventually the story came to be this, that in the face of Christian animosity and hatred and the killing of Jews, especially in the time of the Crusades, the stories are used this way, that it became not simply the expected, but the courageous, the faithful thing for Jews to do, was to kill their own children rather than to expose them to apostasy of the loss of faith in the divine name by being forced to become Christians. So this story has been told and retold in many, many different ways over the time, over the centuries, and we'll see how finally in the death camps at Auschwitz it comes to take on yet more poignancy and yet more capacity to move us to understand this people as truly the people of promise. I'm afraid we do have to stop now so as to keep the rest of our events on schedule today, and I hope that in the rest of the week we won't have as many obscure references to ancient texts, so that you'd be able to join in and ask me important questions like how old was Isaac at the time of the binding, because that's what this is going to be all about. I'm happy to stay here for longer to deal with anybody's comments or questions about this narrative, but I'm afraid that we really do have to end these sessions formally on time, so that anyone's free to leave for other matters. Anyhow, that's today's formal session.
I have a question.
Please.
Your colleague, Ted Ludwig, mentioned when he was telling us about the Muslims,
yes,
that they also believe that Ishmael was also in the same position is being offered up.
Yes, that's right.
And that's what the Muslim world believes.
They retell this story in the Quran as though it is Ishmael whom Abraham is killing, not Isaac. And they have an annual festival in which they, in that telling the story, it's pretty clearly a story about the animal sacrifice replacing the human sacrifice. Because in its annual version, similar to the Deuteronomy 26 passage that you just read for us at the beginning, the festival is associated with the killing of a lamb. To this day, millions and millions of Muslims around the world in October observe this holiday known as Eid al-Adha, and kill a small animal, generally speaking a lamb or a goat, and then the food of that animal is it's roasted over a fire, and then the food is distributed to the poor. So there's a dimension of ethics and of compassion and of mercy, that you have a duty to look after the needy, that arises out of gratitude for the fact that we are no longer on the line, so to speak, as a result of the sacrifice of Ishmael, which it's called the sacrifice.